Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. There are a few people in public life that I have come to admire more over the years than our guest for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Congressman Stephen King, now a former congressman, but a man who served with great distinction in the House of Representatives representing the people of Iowa for, well, I've lost track of how many terms, but it was quite a few. And in the course of it, he became really the lodestar, I think, for conservatives both in the Congress and far beyond as a man of principle, of profound conviction, and great integrity. And it is one of the great sadnesses of my life that he is no longer serving in the United States Congress, where he is urgently needed at the moment, for reasons that we're going to talk about, among many other things with him. But let me first say, Steve King, it is so good to have you with us. I'm very appreciative of the book Over Your Shoulder, Walking Through the Fire, which, of course, is your memoirs about your experiences on Capitol Hill and much else, including presidential politics, which are now once again in flower in your native state. And we'll talk more with you about that as well. But again, just first of all, thank you for giving us an hour of your time, sir. It's great to have a chance.
Well, Frank, thanks a lot for having me on. And I'm just a little embarrassed by that introduction. You know, I'm just another one of those creatures that created by God with a normal person with an irregular history and job. And we're still in the same thing, serving and looking for all the ways we can to improve and save the greatest civilization the world has ever seen. And you've been on it for a long time, and I'm glad to be a partner in that with you.
Well, amen to all of that. Let me ask you about the Congress, for starters. In the past few months, as you know, conservatives, not as numerous as we would like, but still there in some number, including in the House Freedom Caucus, have essentially established a sort of anchor to windward, if I can use that nautical expression, for the House of Representatives, forcing the man who would go on to become Speaker after 15 different votes to make a number of important, we were told, concessions about process and about accountability and about substance as well. Sadly, in the course of the recent debate and thrash over the debt ceiling, some of those promises appear not to have been kept, with very negative consequences, I think, for the Republic, but also for the House of Representatives under Speaker Kevin McCarthy. If you would, sir, let's start this conversation by sort of level setting on where you think we are in the wake of all of that. And have I characterized reasonably accurately where we were just a few days ago? And I'd like to get your thoughts about where we're going next.
Well, first I would say that the 15 votes that went on in the House of Representatives, that was a very healthy exercise that took place. I never believed that Kevin McCarthy should ever be the Speaker of the House. I'd ask the question, does he have a conscience and does he have a soul? Well, have a soul, but I'd like to know a little bit more about that one that I can't seem to find. And I've watched him from the time he came into Congress and to the things, the maneuvers that he had made. A lot of that is in my book. But when I watched this play out, the 15 votes and the 19 to 20 that stuck together as strongly as they did, I really didn't think that would hold, that they would. I thought they would crack. And some of them thought that I'd be disappointed in them. They were using my name in the negotiations. I'm grateful for that. But in the end, I saw how the dynamics went. And it got to the place where I've been to this place at least twice in my legislative life where you're standing on a principle, you're maybe even standing alone on a principle, and you say, I'm going to stand here to the end. But things can shift in that in those negotiations, and the issue becomes about you rather than the principle. And if that happens, then it's time to make those concessions, cut the deal, and move on. That's what they did. They stood nobly for a strong, long time, and finally it came to where they had to make their deal and move on. But with that deal became a number of conditions that were written into that, some of them spoken, some of them written, some of them published, some of them not. But part of this was the debt ceiling. And when we got to the debt ceiling, the bill that came through that had the support of all but about four Republicans, and a few of those others, maybe I don't know their names. I know the names of the four I'm mentioning, and that's the Iowa congressional delegation. But it had the support of essentially the rest of them. And it was a strong message, although it didn't take our national budget where it needs to go. But it was a significant cut from what Biden wanted to do. And it got rid of the 87,000 IRS agents. And it got rid of the carbon credits, the hundreds of billions of dollars of carbon credits that were written in on the Green New Deal. A number of other provisions that were taken out and that to get us closer to a fiscal responsibility. But Kevin McCarthy had a commitment to support that, and he did, and he negotiated that quite a while. I know at one point, I believe it was Ralph Norman that said, I want you to fight for our positions and our decisions and our deal as hard as you fought for the speaker's gavel. That's a really good high standard to hang over this speaker's head anytime he goes a little squishy on us, and he will. But what I've learned is that when you're dealing with people that don't believe, eventually you're going to be disappointed. And we should have known this. It was come to this place. So once Kevin McCarthy capitulated to Biden in the final negotiations of this, that, I think, broke the bond of the temporary honeymoon between the conservatives in the House, who are the ones that had made the deal to elect him as speaker, and going forward in the future on McCarthy's future. So I think, I don't know if I go quite so far as to say his days are numbered, but they're going to need some marriage counseling if this is going to get put back together, Frank.
There is talk, as you know, about betrayal, I would say, of the House position. Obviously, very much driven by the conservative wing in the Republican caucus, prompting the exercise known as vacating the chair. An agreement that very reluctantly, Kevin McCarthy mm-hmm. made to have a single member instigate that process and set the stage for a vote in the full House. Would you recommend that be done at this point, sir?
You know, that's a hard question to answer with confidence on what it would be, because there's a dynamic that goes on inside the House that, if you're in the middle of that, you're living it. You're talking to people as you go by. You're watching other people, who they're talking to, what the conversation is. I wouldn't want to make that recommendation unless I knew the votes were there. And people say this, that you can't beat somebody with nothing. We actually did that with John Boehner. If you remember, we went without a designated speaker for, a month or so? Until Paul Ryan finally was selected as the Speaker of the House. So you can beat somebody with nobody, but I don't know if this is egregious enough yet that could be done. And the fight over his speakership is pretty fresh from January. So let's see how that goes. If I were in the Congress today, I don't know that I would make that motion right now, but I want to make sure my ground was secure and hopefully have a place to go with a speaker as an alternative.
So I guess the bottom line is not so much whether it's egregious enough, but whether it is politically the right time and the right circumstances, and the absence of somebody as an obvious mm-hmm. successor who could command a majority of the House is obviously a consideration in all of that. Congressman, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back, though, with more. And I'd like to broaden the lens beyond the debt ceiling and talk a bit more about some very important substantive mm-hmm. issues that should be before the House and what the House of Representatives under Republican leadership should do about them.
We'll be right Thanks, back. Thanks, Frank.
Steve King on all of that right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese Communist Party's capture of American elites has decisively helped Beijing wage unrestricted warfare against our country for decades. Especially damaging have been its old friends in America's financial sector, who have underwritten with our money the economic and military buildup of the People's Republic of China. Sequoia Capital's Neil Shen is one such enabler of Chinese hegemonic ambitions. He reportedly is not merely among Beijing's friends. He actually has worked for the regime there, helping it gain potentially decisive advantages by acquiring and developing militarily relevant U.S. technologies. Unfortunately, a promising House Intelligence Committee investigation into such assistance was shut down after Sequoia made large contributions to Kevin McCarthy's Victory Fund. Sounds like another good reason to fire the speaker. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're visiting with former Congressman Steve King of Iowa, a man very much, once again, in the midst of the political fray as things are hotting up in his native state of Iowa, where the first in the Republican caucuses will be taking place to select the nominee for the Republican Party in the presidential elections of 2024. Steve, we're going to talk more about politics in a moment, but I did want to ask you about a substantive issue that it seems to me takes on all the more urgency in light of what we just saw in the debt ceiling fight. And that is, we're facing at the moment a very real and growing threat to the sovereignty of the United States of America in the form of an effort to essentially surrender our public health policy decision-making to an unaccountable international organization known as the World Health Organization, or WHO. We've talked a little bit about what's wrong with this picture. And it seems to me that, especially if Speaker McCarthy is in a mood to make amends with his conservative colleagues, this would be one of the things that he should do for that reason alone, to say nothing of the importance of it to the future of our constitutional republic, namely withdrawing from the World Health Organization, ending our funding of it before it can begin to impose on us its diktats over what is a public health emergency of international concern, as it's called, and, as importantly, what we must do about it. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, Frank, I just think of the World Health Organization and the Chinese, essentially their influence in that, their influence through the connections with the World Health Organization, what they have done and how they handled the COVID epidemic. And on top of that, we just saw the news here yesterday or the day before that Kim Jong-un has been named to the executive board of the World Health Organization. I don't want to turn the health of the free world, the first world, over to the Chinese or the North Koreans, but we saw what they did. And for example, they quarantined people in the province where COVID burst out, and quarantined them, but they let the Chinese travel to other places in the world, and it spread the virus all over. You saw very heavy, high concentrations and high deaths in northern Italy. What was that about? Well, the Chinese bought some of the name brand leather works, and then they delivered in Chinese to do the work on the cheap, and that cheap product. So bringing the Chinese in and the senior people in Italy killed thousands of them. These people are going to manage our health with their social credit score and apply that to the the medical treatments that we get, it's bad enough to be fenced in under Obamacare and have my healthcare practitioners be guided by actuarial tables on what they can prescribe and how they can treat me, let alone have a world organization and hand over America's sovereignty and the health and the vitality of the freest people the world has ever known to the people that are living under the slavery of communism. It has got to be completely abhorrent to any patriotic American to allow any piece of that to happen.
Amen. Let me come back to something you touched on there a little bit more pointedly, sir. And that is that one aspect of the World Health Organization's agenda, in partnership with the World Economic Forum, and yes, the Chinese Communist Party, and Bill Gates, and Big Pharma, and I'm sorry to say, the Biden administration, is the institution of a digital identification system that would give every human being on Earth a QR code, which would then create a digital basis for monitoring their health, yes, but also surveilling them and ultimately, as with the Chinese social credit system, controlling them. And this is going forward. It's being, you know, the infrastructure for it is being put into place globally, but also here in the United States, there's an effort afoot now, according to Dr. Robert Malone, by the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, whatever that is, to put into place a national digital health ID for every American, which would then be, you know, obviously partnered up with this global thing. What could possibly go wrong with such an arrangement, sir, as you see it?
Well, at first, it blows up the constraints of HIPAA, for starters. The confidentiality that was written into our entire healthcare system and anybody associated with it quite a number of years ago now to protect the confidentiality of our healthcare records. And so that's to put this out into a central database up into the cloud. It's a cloud system that they're proposing. Put that up into the cloud, and who's got access? Who's got the keys to do that? Well, the people that set it up for one thing and the people they make a deal with for another thing. We've seen leakages of all kinds of our confidential information go. So once it's in a place where it's accessible and consolidated, then on top of that, not only the QR code piece of this that identifies you, but they have facial recognition programs, iris recognition program, and on top of all of that, then they apply the algorithms that not only would dictate what we get for healthcare and tell us when we have to go for a checkup or when we don't have to go for a checkup, to the dentist, to the optometrist, and on with that, but that can be also spread down into what we eat. And with the digital currency that Biden has been proposing here for the last two or more years, the digital currency indexes in with the digital health record, and our identity is managed by algorithms in the cloud. I can't think of anything less free than having, what is it, Big Brother up there writing algorithms to dictate the activities of every human being on the planet. And then the people that are planning this, we know, Frank, they want to go down to 500 million people, they believe, is all the planet can sustain from the 7 billion that we have on the way to about 9 billion before it flattens off again, down to 500 million. How ridiculous is that? And how ghastly is the thought of reducing the population on the planet? None of them have volunteered to be part of that side of the experiment, I noticed, Frank.
Yeah, funny how that works.
Yeah.
And it's not entirely clear how they accomplish that kind of reduction. Is it going to be via, you know, pandemics that are unleashed upon us to wipe out billions of people? Is it starvation, other kinds of, privation? But it does, at the end of the day, it comes back to what you said, Steve, and that is, this is the antithesis of freedom. It is utterly contrary to our Constitution and the guarantees that it provides for our liberty. And it's just mind-boggling that this thing is as advanced as it is and may well be completely instituted unless, I would argue, Speaker McCarthy makes clear we are not going to be governed by the World Health Organization. We're not going to fund it. We are not going to subscribe to its edicts. We are going to withdraw from the organization. Before this trap, really, the digital gulag, we call it, particularly, closes in around us. And Congressman, I just can't tell you how important I think it is that we be hearing from you about these insights, as we are now blessed to hear from another of your colleagues, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. Mm-hmm. Those who are serving today need to be really seized with what you've just said, and I appreciate you visiting with us to talk about it, and what we'll do with that, we'll discuss on the other side of a very short break. Stay tuned, folks, for more with Congressman Steve King of Iowa right after this.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. We're visiting with the author of Walking Through the Fire, a very important memoir by Congressman Steve King about his life and times in Washington and lessons learned from all of that. Lessons that it is important for us to learn as well. And Congressman, I wanted to just say, you sort of alluded to it at several points in the conversation thus far, that we're looking at a threat from the Chinese Communist Party in the form of, the China model that was imposed with the World Health Organization's help upon us during the pandemic, the COVID pandemic. We're watching their efforts to institute a new digital gulag through the World Health Organization and other means. But more generally, sir, we are facing, it would seem to me, having worked with President Reagan on the last of what he called the existential threats to freedom that every generation must face, namely the Soviet Union, that this one makes the old USSR pale by comparison, maybe even to insignificance. That would be the Chinese Communist Party. How do you see the magnitude of the danger we are currently facing from the CCP, as it's known? And do you think that the Biden administration is complicit in intensifying that threat?
I don't have any doubt that the Biden administration is complicit in intensifying this. They've helped facilitate this all along. There is plenty of financial records out there that shows you what their motive likely is, and I believe that's what it is. But I just dial back to about the late 80s and the early 90s when I watched with my eyes as the smart financial gurus in America said, we want to become an information age, be an information economy and a service economy, not a manufacturing economy. So they offloaded our manufacturing over into China, which created all of this wealth in China. And they've had a growth in their GDP of 10% a year for a cycle of years along the way. It's flattening out now, I understand. But the wealth that's been grown in China has been at the expense of the United States. It's like looking at a picture of Dubai 40 years ago and looking at it today, built with American money. American money built Dubai. American money is building China. And they're taking that money and taking lessons and investing it against us and around the world. I see things like, for example, they go into Madagascar and they load up 50,000 young people, take them to China, and they teach them over there. They teach them Mandarin, the Chinese way of life. They put them back in Madagascar to replicate the Chinese way of life. They control the ends of the Panama Canal, at least I'm told. I've not had eyes on that. So this insidious encroachment into us, now we have to ask the Chinese if we can buy an aspirin. Our pharmaceuticals that are produced over there in that country, I can't look around my house. But the Chinese are insidiously investing their dollars in taking over control of our government, and in doing so, control of our minds and our activities, and also limiting some of the military developments that we have and growing theirs, challenging us in the Straits of Taiwan, challenging around the world. I see, and one thing that's missing in much of the dialogue is, what's the motivation for this? Why wouldn't the Chinese just want to be like Americans? We're richer, we're happier. But it is the clash of civilizations, as Samuel Huntington wrote. And so the three pieces that are out there now are the communists led by Xi in China. And that is the best funded, the most insidious threat that we have. The other one we talked about a little bit earlier, though, and that's the World Economic Forum, the component of that, the globalists. Those two are running a parallel path against our civilization, against the first world civilization, of which the United States of America is the flagship for the fleet of the Western civilization. They're running against those values. They're atheists on both sides. They don't believe in individual liberty in both sides, but they aren't clashing with each other because they've got a common cause. If they're able to defeat us, Frank, I want to go on record of this. I won't live to see it. I pray I won't live to see it. But if we are defeated as the dominant civilization in the world, if they destroy the first world culture, they will then clash each other. The communist world will come up against the globalist elitists, and that will be another clash of titans. So the survival of the United States in the end, and the survival of our civilization, actually is about the survival of freedom, God-given liberty, and individual liberty. And it's atheist, and it's a dark, dark world of a long period of potential dark ages if we let this happen, Frank.
I couldn't agree more. And you know very well, Congressman, that there's a third element to this that is similarly minded in terms of achieving global domination. Similarly of the view that we're the impediment to realizing it. And similarly, working with the other two, the globalists and the Chinese Communist Party, and that would be the Sharia supremacists. They have in mind a caliphate that's different than the communist Chinese running the world and different than, you know, Davos man running. But they'll sort that out, as you say, once we're gone. And that's what the stakes are. Make no mistake about it. I just wanted to commend you. I don't know if you've seen it yet, sir, but our book, The Indictment, really lays out much of what you were just talking about in terms of this sustained, comprehensive, patient, and unfortunately all too successful Chinese program of unrestricted warfare against our country and the capture of our elites. And again, you've had extensive service at both the state and the federal level in public life. You've seen firsthand captured elites. You are an example of someone who, of course, was never captured, but among your former colleagues, both past and those currently serving, there is a legion of people who have thrown in with the Chinese communists. I know that this is a matter of concern to you, of course, and it should be to all of us. But unfortunately, too few of us, and this is one of the reasons why we wrote this book, is to connect some dots. So, you know, we see them buying up farmland in places like Iowa, I think, certainly elsewhere in the Midwest. We see them hollowing out our industrial base. It wasn't just, you know, our captains of industry who thought we should deindustrialize. It was the Chinese who were expropriating effectively, in some cases, you know, lock, stock, and barrel, our factories. But those are the sorts of things that we've got to understand fit into a larger and comprehensive effort to take us down. And I appreciate your clarity on that point. Do you think, sir, among those who are not captured, that there is an appreciation among other members of the House of Representatives, for example, of the gravity of the danger we face from the CCP?
You know, there are a few, of course, and you know who they are, Frank, and maybe more so than I do. We know that there are not nearly enough. And in my time there, and it'll be in those arenas, every arena that I could find, I wanted to jump in there and do battle to protect our civilization and our Constitution. But I never found a depth of understanding in any kind of a coalition of much magnitude for what the Chinese threat is. And we've done work back into those years together to fight the Chinese threat. I never really found that level of coalition there that understood the insidiousness and the magnitude of the Chinese threat to our civilization. Neither did I find people that were willing to do battle with the World Economic Forum, that the global governance approach with all of that in each of these pieces we're talking about. And so they need to be educated a lot more. And I don't know that they pay it. They're very busy, for one thing. And I sat here in my desk for 2.5 weeks and did almost nothing day and night except drill into the World Economic Forum and into the, not as far into the WHO as I ought to be into, but into it to some depth. And it gave me an appreciation for how much attention you have to pay to get the understanding that you have and the understanding that I am seeking. That's I think Congress has a ways to go, and the constituents are going to have to get their attention because they're too busy. Yeah. So Congressman.
Yeah, which brings me to one of the points that I think is vital to this conversation on so many scores, whether it's the debt ceiling or whether it's the response to what was done or whether it's the World Health Organization and what is in prospect there, or this question of China or other things that we'll be talking about in a moment, energy security, for example. Engaging your Congress person, a representative man or woman, whatever, is vital. And another way to elevate all of this, as you know so well, because you are a master of this technique, is through the process of the presidential election process and the primaries, particularly in your case, the caucuses in Iowa. Do you see the early runnings now of that China featured prominently as it should be?
Boy, that's a good question here in this state. And I have been involved in the Iowa First of the Nation, Iowa caucus politics going clear back into the 80s, at least, if not even before that. And so I have a decent feel for this. What is going on here as far as China is concerned? It's a little bit muted because our longtime former governor, Terry Branstad, 36 years as governor, I believe that's the right number. He had served as governor longer than anyone in the history of the United States of America. I actually offered to plan the celebration. He declined my help and ran his own. But in any case, he was the ambassador to China under Donald Trump for about 3.5 years. He came back early, about a half a term early, and opened up a consulting company to facilitate more business between China and the United States.
I was afraid you were going to say that, sir. We have to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about Terry Branstad, emperor of the captured elite. That and more with Steve King on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. Thank you. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese Communist Party's capture of American elites has decisively helped Beijing wage unrestricted warfare against our country for decades. Especially damaging have been its old friends in America's financial sector who have underwritten with our money the economic and military buildup of the People's Republic of China. Sequoia Capital's Neil Shen is one such enabler of Chinese hegemonic ambitions. He reportedly is not merely among Beijing's friends. He actually has worked for the regime there, helping it gain potentially decisive advantages by acquiring and developing militarily relevant U.S. technologies. Unfortunately, a promising House Intelligence Committee investigation into such assistance was shut down after Sequoia made large contributions to Kevin McCarthy's Victory Fund. Sounds like another good reason to fire the speaker. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and we're continuing this really important conversation with one of, I think, our country's best now former legislators. His name is Congressman Stephen King. He is the author of Walking Through the Fire and a very active participant, still, I'm happy to say, in the public policy fray. He remains very much in the arena. And we were talking a little bit about somebody else who is still in the arena, your longtime governor, Terry Branstad, also a former ambassador to the People's Republic of China. You were just saying at the close of that last block, and we had to bring it to a peremptory close, so I want you to pick up where we left off. He's opened a consulting firm, which apparently has as among its clients, as is often the case, the Chinese Communist Party or representatives thereof. What is the former Governor Branstad, now Ambassador, ex-Ambassador Branstad, up to in this regard? And how is that translating into, well, some problematic public policy positions?
Well, as I saw this unfold, it happened to be I was watching local TV out of Sioux City, Iowa, and here came the face of a former governor and ambassador to China who had a personal friendly relationship with Xi. That's why he became ambassador, supposedly. He launched a consulting company to facilitate and accelerate business relationships between the United States and China and the China and the United States, just at the time where America realized we need to divest ourselves from China and start moving our business investments back home or other places around the world. Amazingly, maybe at that time, but I didn't learn about it until a little bit later, he became the lead consultant, his firm, for one of the two CO2 pipeline agendas that are being driven here in Iowa. And we've watched as...
And that CO2 stands for carbon dioxide, of course. And the idea is that what comes out as a result of exploitation of fossil fuels that could endanger the climate, we're told, needs to be secured underground. Is that...
That's their strategy. And of course, I could go and give you the whole science argument on the other side of this thing, but that would be a little too time consuming. It's just that they have latched onto carbon dioxide as a global warming gas that now they can attack everywhere all of the time with their agenda. And yes, oil production does produce that, but also in where we have high ethanol production in the upper Midwest. There's the CO2 is one third of a bushel of corn that emits into the atmosphere. And so we have the highest concentration of the purest CO2 and high volume of it anywhere in the world. It's 98% pure. So when Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act pays carbon credits to sequester this CO2 into mile deep old oil wells is what they're really talking about. This launched the avarice of some big businesses in the world, and one of them is called Summit Ag Solutions, run by the top Republican donor in Iowa, Bruce Rastetter, who is like that with Ambassador Terry Branstad, who is his consultant, surely invested in that company. And this whole operation that's going on out of Bruce Rastetter's Operation Summit looks like a Terry Branstad political operation. They have now controlled the legislature in Iowa. They are completely handcuffed to defend the property rights of Iowa farms. They are prepared to bulldoze through the property rights of hundreds of miles of the best farmland in the world to lay 3,600 miles of pipeline across six states in the upper Midwest, the lion's share of it in Iowa. Some of it goes to North Dakota to the oil fields. Some of it goes to Illinois to the oil fields. And there's two huge entities here, Frank, and it should put the chills in people. And it's this. The one huge entity is the World Economic Forum. Larry Fink, the CEO of Navigators, CEO of BlackRock, as they're driving the Navigator agenda under BlackRock, he controls $10 trillion. And he sits at the elbow of Klaus Schwab and George Soros at the World Economic Forum. And they've been cooking this up for over 20 years. Now they have the appropriations. And then Bruce Rastetter is the Republican side. He controls the legislatures in North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa. And the governors there and the leadership within the legislatures and the party leadership. And those two have teamed up. And this ends up being hundreds of billions of dollars of 100% sunk money.
All of it subsidized and generating profits for those participating. I mentioned to you off air, Congressman, that I listened to our mutual friend Daniel Horowitz doing a very interesting interview on this very subject back on the 5th of May with a representative by the name of John Hansen in, I believe it was South Dakota. And the rape of the land that is associated with this, to say nothing of the scam that seems to be afoot from an environmental point of view, among other things, is really outrageous. And so I appreciate your, shedding light on what's happening in your native state. It's just another example of what I have to say, going back to China for a moment, is a very profound concern. We seem to be taking offline between this scheme and wind farms and solar farms and Chinese purchases, large quantities of America's agricultural productive farmland, as you say, in Iowa, the best in the world. And I don't sense that there's really much thought being given to the implications for our food security, to say nothing of our national security more generally. Your thoughts quickly, we've got a minute.
Well, as far as Chinese buying up farmland across the country, we need to push back against that in every state and prohibit them from purchasing farmland. We actually did that in Iowa in 1980. Those that had bought in were grandfathered in. I happen to know that from experience. But what's going on in Iowa, and I handed the data over to our Attorney General, Brenna Byrd, who was formerly my chief of staff, by the way, the material that shows that they are forming LLCs, buying up chunks of land, 1,500 acres here, 1,500 acres there, bundling up that land and managing it from a management firm. And inside the LLCs, we cannot find out who the investors are. That's where you will find the Chinese, in my opinion. And I hope they investigate it, but they sounded a little handcuffed on it too, Frank.
Well, there's a lot of handcuffing going on. It's sort of what goes down with the Chinese Communist Party, I'm afraid. All the more reason why we've got to break those handcuffs free. Mm-hmm. Congressman, we have to take a final break. We will be right back, and we're going to talk with you about the border, something that you've been warning about for decades, and rightly so. Your insights into the stakes for us now are vitally needed. We'll be right back with that right after this. Welcome back to this final installment of this remarkable conversation with a very important public, well, intellectual, but also public servant, now retired from the Congress. His name is Steve King. He is, among other things, the author of the book you see there over his shoulder, Walking Through the Fire, the true story of his experiences in Washington, D.C., and lessons that we all should learn from them. Congressman, I did want to switch gears slightly. All of these topics are interconnected, of course, with what's going on Capitol Hill and what the Chinese are up to and what the Biden administration is doing to our country. It's a particularly egregious story of, well, malfeasance, I guess one might say, as well as betrayal. When you look at what Joe Biden has done to our southern border, for as long as I've known you, you've been warning about the perils to our country of essentially, unchecked migration. It's now, you know, open season, basically, for anybody who wants to from anywhere in the world to come here. We did a fascinating webinar on the issue with our Committee on the Present Danger of China last week, talking about the health implications, tuberculosis, now measles, who knows what other diseases, among other things that are coming in with those folks that are illegally entering America. Give us your quick take on where we are now and the vital need for corrective action.
Well, we've gone from, I watched this happen when we had, actually Eisenhower had a project, I can't even say the name of it now because somebody would say that I'm a racist, but with the fewest number of people had the most effective border security that we have, at least in living memory. And after that, the border was secured incrementally less and less. And by the time we got to Ronald Reagan in 1986, he signed the Amnesty Act, which sacrificed a chunk of the rule of law. He regretted it afterwards, as I've learned from General Ed Meese, but that was 86. And subsequent to that, each president enforced immigration law incrementally less and less until we got to Donald Trump, who used some creative things to try to put some of these genies back in the bottle, including Rule 42. But when we got to Joe Biden, he's carrying out the George Soros agenda. And this agenda, I want to say straight out, it is the Great Replacement Theory. I was called out on that in an interview I did in August in Vienna of 2018. And for a term that I was asked about if what I described was the Great Replacement Theory. And I said, I guess you can call it that. And the press pummeled me for saying, I guess you could call it that. I want to say this right out loud. That is what it is. That's what it was. It is a plan. When they pushed the millions into Middle Easterners into Europe, it was the same strategy. When they're pushing them across our southern border, it's the same strategy. They know what they're doing. They're doing it on purpose. Joe Biden said straight out that after a certain year, America will no longer be a white majority. And he said, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. That's outrageous to think that you want to scrub white people out of the United States of America. It's as racist as you can get. And by the way, there was a chart down at the Southern Poverty Law Center, the SPLC. I have pictures of that in my archives of them keeping track and projecting when they put whites into a minority. Well, it isn't race so much. I've said it isn't about race. It's about the culture. And whenever you import someone into the United States, you are importing their culture, and they will replicate it unless you have a strong program to assimilate. So they're replacing the culture because they've destroyed assimilation as a tool. And now we sit with the rule of law and immigration destroyed. He is unconstitutionally failing to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That's Biden. If there ever was anything that's impeachable, it's the willful destruction of the civilization of the United States of America. And he ought to be impeached. And why that's not happening is, an open question right now. But I'd say additionally...
Well, isn't the problem, as has been pointed out by lots of folks, that Republicans, not all but some, are in favor of greater immigration and illegal as well as legal, of course, and see some benefit to the country economically of, low-paid, unskilled workers being here in large numbers?
Frank, I'd say it's not the benefit to the country, it's the benefit to their bottom line. And I've watched them transition into that. I watched the freedom-loving people in Northwest Iowa, the Dutch farmers up there that start bringing their, they start growing their cow herds to milking herds, and then they become for illegal immigration. And they've had meetings they've invited me to pummel me on the border security. They say, who's going to milk our cows? I had the president of the Pork Producers Organization in my office pleading, well, more not completely demanding, that I be an advocate for opening up the borders because he needs more labor. And I said, how many hogs do you feed? 10,000. How many did you feed 10 years ago? 2,000. Who did the chores then? He said, I did. And now you want to grow your herd, and now you want me to validate your law-breaking for your expansion. That's a microcosm. What's happened in the hotels and all across this country, it's about their bottom line, and it destroys the rule of law. That's the central pillar of American exceptionalism, the rule of law, Frank.
It is, and we see it over the side in so many different respects. Equal justice under law, as you say, a cornerstone for our constitutional republic is, I fear, a thing of the past. Congressman, just we've got a minute left. Concluding thoughts that you would like to impart based on everything you've shared?
I would say, Frank, that I've watched over my adult lifetime, mostly in the last 25 to 30 years, every institution in America has been corrupted to some degree or another, and that includes our churches, our schools, our libraries, our communities, our families. And of all of that corruption that's taken place, it is the hardcore left that has pushed themselves into that strategically. And then you start to try to name the components that don't have a Chinese component in it. The Chinese are in a big part of this. But the ideology of leftism that says we should feel guilty about who we are. I'd make one further point, and that is this, that when the day is likely to come that China will equal the United States in GDP, but they've got 4.5 people for every one of ours. If that day comes, we're still going to have 4.5 times the per capita GDP of the Chinese. And we don't use that number nearly often enough. Per capita GDP is an indication of the force and power of a people.
You are, as always, an exemplar of our people, Congressman Steve King, and we appreciate your leadership, continuing leadership, now out of office. Come back to us, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you for your insights today. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you'll be back tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, go forth and multiply.